You're listening to The Takeaway. I'm Matt Katz from WNYC, filling in this week for Tenzina Vega. Good to have you with us. In Texas, a statewide mask mandate is being lifted today, and all businesses will be allowed to operate at full capacity. Governor Greg Abbott announced the rollbacks at a press conference last week.
COVID has not, suddenly disappeared. COVID still exists in Texas, in the United States, and across the globe. But it is clear from the recoveries, from the vaccinations, from the reduced hospitalizations, and from the safe practices that Texans are using, that state mandates are no longer needed.
The move has been criticized by President Joe Biden and CDC Director Dr. Rochelle Walensky. They, along with many other public health experts, say that easing up restrictions now could pose a major setback to efforts to get COVID-19 under control. While coronavirus cases have declined in Texas since their winter peak, the state has still seen more than 5,000 new cases per day over the past 2 weeks. That's a 7% increase from the previous two-week period, according to the New York Times. Many Democratic officials in Texas have expressed their opposition to the governor's rollbacks, but their ability to enforce stricter public safety measures is relatively limited. Under the governor's order, some restrictions can be put back in place if coronavirus hospitalizations rise above a certain level. But even in those cases, county judges are prohibited from jailing or fining people for refusing to wear masks. So what do these rollbacks mean for Texans at the local level? For more on that, I'm joined by Plano, Texas Mayor Harry LaRosselier. Welcome back to The Takeaway, Mayor.
Thank you, Matt. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's our pleasure. So were local leaders like yourself given any heads up before last week's big announcement that these rollbacks were coming, or did they come as a surprise to you?
No, we saw the writing on the wall. We saw Texas open up to 75% a couple weeks earlier, and when there was an announcement pending, we figured it was one of two things, and both happened. It was 100% opening, and then the lifting of the mask mandate. So it really wasn't a real surprise that this occurred, at least not for me.
So what does this mean in Plano? What COVID-19 related restrictions are you able to continue enforcing?
Well, really, the state has preempted our local authority to change to put anything in place. And so really what it means is that businesses will be open 100% and masks are not required. For me here in Plano, my message has been fairly consistent. This is about personal responsibility. It's about caring for yourself and then certainly caring for those around you, your loved ones and your neighbors and the people you don't know. And so that's the message we're continuing to drive home for our citizens, that for the safety of our community, we strongly encourage that we maintain all the practices that's gotten us to this point where we're so close to getting on the other side.
But are you expecting to see less mask wearing and less social distancing in Plano in the coming days now that this is going into effect?
I would think so. I think when you have mixed messages from policymakers, the confusion is the result, and there's inconsistency in behavior. And so it would be nice if we were all on the same page. I think the what's going to happen is that now businesses will be forced to make their decisions as to whether they're going to allow folks with or without mask, and that can create conflict. And I think that becomes a public problem, because you're going to find disagreements as a result. Studies show that when there is a law in place, compliance is significantly higher. So if we saw this play out, Matt, and during the summer where we had a shutdown, and frankly, opening up too quickly led to a surge. And so we're so close. If you look at our community, we're 12% of our population in Collin County, where Plano resides, just north of Dallas, mm-hmm. is vaccinated, 12%. And so we have a ways to go, and we're not that far away. I'm optimistic that things are moving in the right direction. We just need to give it a bit more time. And so I'm asking our citizens on that basis, is this is what we should do.
You said earlier that you're concerned about potential conflicts with business owners who might ask people to wear masks, but they're not mandated, even though they're not mandated to wear masks. What are business owners in the city saying about the rollbacks from the state right now?
By and large, the feedback has been many businesses prefer to keep the mask ordinance, I think, for the safety of their employees and the patrons. The majority of citizens realize the seriousness of this pandemic and the fact that the social distancing and the measures we've taken has worked. It's a discomfort. We all have cabin fever. I'm tired of putting this piece of thing on my face and I'll forget it and I go back into my car, and it happens all the time. And so we're all at that point where the fatigue is there, but we also realize that in order for us to accomplish something of significance, we have to come together and feel the collective pain together. And again, we've gone from a position of love and compassion in our city. We don't have a hammer over your head and say, you must do this. We say, we need you to do this for your community. And our community by and large has responded. But I do suspect that with this lifting, there's just going to be confusion. There's going to be some that already did not want to wear the mask, will feel compelled not to. I saw a video just the other day at a Trader Joe, which is a supermarket locally, where someone wanted to come in without a mask, and the employee said no, and it was on social media, and it wasn't physical confrontation, it was a verbal one, but that was unnecessary. That's unnecessary, and I suspect more of that will occur.
Yeah, that's unnecessary and unsettling. When you were on the Takeaway back at the beginning of January, you were talking about Texas's vaccine rollout, and I'm curious what the status of things. You had just said earlier that 12% in the county, in your county, have gotten the shots. In terms of the rollout of the vaccines, are things smoothing out a bit? Are people getting more access to the vaccine?
Yes, it was. You know, it was at the beginning. It was clumsy. It was uncoordinated. It was. But there's no one to blame for that, Matt. The difficulty when dealing something of this scale is that you can plan as much as you want, and then things are going to happen that you didn't anticipate, that frankly are out of your control, but you're responsible for. That's really what it comes down to. And so we've worked through some of the logistics, supply chain issues that really weren't city related, but we're the first point of contact for our citizens. And so something breaks down, they call us. They don't call Texas. They don't call the Austin. They don't call the governor. They call Plano City Council and myself and our city staff. And so it's smoothed out. And since with the new administration, we've obviously seen an increase of numbers of vaccines. The predictability is better. Back then when we spoke in January, we'd find out a day or so before how much dosage we'll get, and then we have to scramble to figure out where to administer it and organize it, where now it's happening more in several weeks in advance, and there's a bit more predictability. We have a super site or two opened up in our city, and we're having coordination with our neighboring cities in Collin County. So it's much better. And there's a long way to go. And we just simply need to be methodical about it and go keep our head down every day and do the task at hand.
Nationwide and in Texas, COVID-19 has had a disproportionate impact on Black and Latino communities. And I wonder what's going on with the Black and Latino neighbors in Plano.
So for us, it's really about information and providing access. So, you know, we've heard about the divide, the digital divide that creates that chasm. And so, again, we make our city staff available to be conduits, and we have nonprofit organizations that we coordinate with locally to get messages out. And we have a number of faith-based organizations in our communities that we connect with to provide information, push out the relevant information as to where to go and how to get your vaccine and help folks get online. So we do the best we can. There's sometimes, again, when we talk about these crises, it brings to light deficiencies in our community. And I suspect when we get to the other side, we hope to address some of those issues, the structural issues that put some of our citizens in a disadvantage.
Later this hour, we're going to be speaking about the $1.9 trillion COVID relief package that's moving through Congress. Do you know yet if there are any provisions in that package that will be particularly helpful for you guys in Plano?
Well, there's a component of that, obviously. I think in general, supporting those that are been deeply affected through COVID is a positive for any community. And so we were fortunate prior to COVID, we've had a real robust economy. Locally, we had an unemployment rate at 3%. It went up to as much as 12% at the worst, and now it's settled in at about 6%. So still for our community, twice as many people are out of work. And so those stimulus funds will be well received. For city, though, we have reduction in sales tax revenue. We're going to see significant property tax decrease in this upcoming year because property tax revenues show up a year later. We've had additional staff resources that we've had to put out for people that are those are not working, that got sick, or those who can't work, needing equipment to work at home. So all those will be the portion that of that bill that's for cities, I think, will be well received, and it will go far towards us addressing some of the shortfalls that we anticipate coming up and that we've and revenue and expenditure that we've seen over the past year.
Very good. And real quick, before I let you go, can you tell me if things are flattening out in terms of COVID infections and hospitalizations in Plano?
Yes. This time last month, Matt, our rolling average is about 84 positive cases a day. We're down to about 20 positive cases a day. So we're moving in the right direction. We're almost there. And I'm urging my citizens and anyone listening to just keep this up for a little longer. We'll see the other side and it'll be better for sure.
Mayor Harry LaRosselier is the mayor of Plano, Texas. Mayor, thank you so much for coming on The Takeaway again. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Matt.
Texas is far from the only state rolling back restrictions related to COVID-19. Mississippi, Arizona, West Virginia, and Connecticut have all eased restrictions in recent weeks, ending mask mandates and limits on indoor capacity. At the same time, the CDC has announced new guidelines for fully vaccinated people in the U.S., including safely socializing indoors with other vaccinated people or those at low risk for severe disease. We're going to talk about all of this and more with Dr. Saad Omer, an infectious disease epidemiologist and director of the Yale Institute for Global Health. Dr. Omer, welcome to the show.
My pleasure.
Let's start with the latest from the CDC about what fully vaccinated people can and can't do. What are the highlights from the new guidelines, and was there anything in there that surprised you?
Actually, no. There was nothing surprising there because it's evidence-based. These vaccines are highly protective against direct disease in all age groups, including the elderly. We have emerging evidence that they may reduce transmission as well, although that evidence is not rock solid. And so therefore, it was only reasonable to say that now that you are vaccinated, you can do certain activities, you can participate in certain activities. So all of the guidelines make sense, and they're not surprising because they're based on evidence.
Was there a difference in the guidance, significant difference between public and private settings?
It's not going to be like a, you know, light switch that, you know, one fine morning, everything is okay. It will be a sort of a dimmer switch. Things will open up gradually, and that's what you're seeing. Public activities where there are a lot of people present, especially indoors, are much higher risk activities, even for vaccinated individuals than these small gatherings. So that was the major difference.
What about traveling?
Well, yes. So the language is that it is being discouraged. I do think it was time for them to have focused on it even now. But the hope is that they will come out with a more fine-tuned guidance. And we are all talking about vaccinated people. And for unvaccinated individuals, there is no reason to change that guidance at this point. But for vaccinated individuals, I think it warrants another look at current travel guidelines so that they can actually engage safely in some of those activities.
What's the purpose of the CDC issuing these updated guidelines? Does it effectively give us a roadmap, a look at what the weeks and months ahead might mean and might look like for the rest of us?
Yeah, I think it does give an idea. And the other thing is, look, public health recommendations are there for a reason. They're not sort of asking everyone to sacrifice their relationships, their engagement, their activities, just for the sake of it. They are there to protect themselves and others. And when there is reason to ease up on some of these guidelines and sort of restrictions or voluntary restrictions in this case, then it is in line with the evidence, and that's rational public health policy.
And are the guidelines also a way to encourage people to get vaccinated? Like, look, this is what awaits you if you get this shot.
Yeah, especially as more and more people get vaccinated. So here's the thing. It's not just the individual vaccination impact, but collective vaccination also impacts individual behavior and the things that we can do. So if more and more people get vaccinated, you can do more and more activities safely. For example, if you're on a plane, and when everyone is vaccinated, or most people are vaccinated, your risk is substantially lower. And actually, we know that with travel, a big chunk of risk comes not just on the not from the plane itself. It comes from your interactions at the airport and the other parts of the travel. And so mm-hmm. so those kinds of things help all of us go back to a lot of the activities that we were doing before this thing struck.
You know, at the same time that these guidelines came out, we're also seeing some shifts on public health measures at the state level. As I mentioned, Texas is lifting pandemic-related restrictions, but there are countless states doing similar thing. Are there differences, though, between the rollback of restrictions in places like Texas and Mississippi compared with up in Connecticut?
Well, there are differences, but I actually... Connecticut has done a good job in terms of pandemic response in a lot of aspects. But in this case, I don't think it is time to lift restrictions, especially indoor dining restrictions. I know our restaurants are hurting. Mm-hmm. I know businesses are hurting. But we prolong the suffering, collective and individual, and in terms of businesses themselves, if we take actions a little too prematurely. So I think we should have, including not just in Texas and Mississippi, but including in Connecticut, we should have waited a few more weeks. I think we will get there where it will be safer to engage in some of these kinds of activities. And by the way, I'm of the view that you don't have to reach full herd immunity or that threshold to be able to sort of ease up on some of these restrictions. I do believe that if you have vaccinated enough of the high-risk individuals or the highest-risk individuals who are at the risk of dying and being hospitalized, because this virus has disproportionate impact on certain groups. It impacts all of us. So this is a pandemic. Nobody has zero risk. But it does impact some people more than the others. So as we start vaccinating those groups, we will get to a situation where even if the rates of infection are high, there's a bit of a, decoupling with mortality and hospitalization and severe disease because you have already vaccinated the most vulnerable. And so in that kind of a situation, it is much safer to ease up on some of these requirements. And we are getting there, not just in Connecticut, but in the near future in Mississippi and Texas as well. So around that time, it will be much safer. And with Connecticut, if I may, it is even more nuanced because the state switched to a purely age-based strategy. That means that while it, in the early phases, it did a really good job of protecting the most vulnerable, above 75, long-term care facilities, etc. As the age group goes down, you know, people with the highest at the highest risk, especially below 55, so it is reasonable and actually preferable to go to not to have an age-based approach only through 75. I think going down to 60, 55 is very reasonable, not just 65 or 75 that some states are doing. Beyond that, you know, what you do is that you are making people at the highest risk in those age groups, you're making them compete with the rest of the population, the rest of us, who have, relatively lower risk of dying and severe disease. And so therefore, you are delaying that impact, that decoupling between infection and the benefit that comes to comes by protecting the most vulnerable through vaccination.
Mm-hmm.
And so then in that kind of a situation, easing up too early has even more concerning consequences.
Sure. As these states ease up a bit on some of these public health measures, do we know how much involvement public health officials, experts like yourselves are involved in this? Is it politics that are playing a major role? Is it a mix of politics and public health advice that the state officials are using to try to come up with these new measures?
Look, there is an interesting dynamic. In various states, and not just in the South, there is this tendency to have quote-unquote consultations with public health people and then do whatever they want to do pretty much anyways. So there is one thing to have consultation, to say it more directly, than to actually have, include that in decision-making. At the federal level, things have substantially changed in terms of there's actual... You can trace a line between public health recommendations. Actually, starting with evidence, you can trace a sort of a line between the emerging evidence, public health recommendations, and then executive decisions. It is not that clear in all states, and it's not just Texas and Mississippi. There are other states, including in the Northeast, where it's one thing to lack of better framing, parade around public health professionals in press conferences, then actually have your decisions based on evidence-based recommendations. Mm-hmm. And so that's one thing. Having said that, I understand. So it's not just political. I think it's a sincerely held belief that they have to have other considerations. And political is not, I'm not a politician, I'm a scientist. So I don't have, admittedly detailed understanding of all the nuances that come with, an elected leader's, pressures and all of that stuff. Setting that aside, there are other non-public health reasons to consider some of these actions. So it is not just that, they're doing it for any nefarious reasons. They're doing it by having other considerations than public health. As part of decision making, and at least that's what it seems. So, in this kind of a situation, sometimes the decisions are not best for public health. But we have evidence, even from other fields, that the best economic response, and it's not even ambiguous now, that the best economic response is the same as the best public health response. Mm. So, you can't have an outbreak that has a different economic response and then not have a direct control and sustainable control. And that's an important word. Not just a direct control, but a sustainable control of the outbreak.
Dr. Saad Omer is an infectious disease epidemiologist and director of the Yale Institute for Global Health. Dr. Omer, thanks so much for walking us through all of this. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
This week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, I'll talk with psychologist Jonathan Haidt about his book, The Anxious Generation.
We're overprotecting in one place, and I'm saying, lighten up, let your kids out. And we're underprotecting in another, and I'm saying, don't let your kids spend 9 hours a day on the internet talking with strange men. It's just not a good idea.
Jonathan Haidt on the New Yorker Radio Hour from WNYC Studios. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Today, the House of Representatives is expected to pass a $1.9 trillion stimulus package, marking the one-year anniversary of the start of the coronavirus pandemic. The American Rescue Plan, which passed the Senate over the weekend along strictly partisan lines, is President Biden's first significant legislative initiative. In an attempt to fight the economic downturn caused by the pandemic, the bill will inject the economy with an unprecedented amount of federal aid that targets families in need of assistance. With me now is economics correspondent for The Washington Post, Heather Long. Heather, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Hi, good to be back.
Heather, talk to me about the most significant pieces of this $1.9 trillion aid package.
Well, certainly everyone, many people in America are buzzing about another round of these $1,400 checks coming out. Those could go out within a matter of days of this package being signed by the president. So we're expecting 150 million households to get the checks this time. That's down a little bit from the 168 million households that received the December package and the one last spring. But there's so much attention on the checks, people forget that there's a lot of other things in this bill. It extends unemployment insurance through Labor Day with an extra $300 a week. And a lot of people are talking about it as a big anti-poverty move. And the reason they say that isn't because of the checks, but because of about $200 billion in new tax credits that are specifically directed towards lower income families. And just to say briefly, that's the child tax credit, the earned income tax credit, and the child care, the child and dependent care tax credit. When you put all those together, that is another big boost to families. The other two biggies in this bill are $350 billion to states and cities. We did not see anything like that in prior bills. And of course, more money for vaccine distribution.
You've reported some startling numbers related to what this means for people in poverty. The bill would take nearly 13 million Americans out of poverty, reduces the number of children living in poverty by 40%. My first thought in reading this was the pandemic is ironically really expanding the social safety net in a way we haven't seen in a generation, maybe, isn't it?
It is. And what we know is when you look at who's been hurt the most by this pandemic, it's basically families who were earning $14 an hour or less. And they've just been decimated. Sitting here in March of 2021, it's still a Great Depression-like scenario for people who earn $14 or less, whereas people who earn $20 or more have actually seen their jobs increase in the past year, which is mind-boggling to think about.
Wow. And the reason why there's such a dent in poverty that this bill is expected to make, is it because of the child tax credit? Is that the major reason for that?
It's really a combination. It's a very comprehensive package. So many people email me and they say, how can you save $1,400? The check is going to lift somebody out of poverty. And I say, you're right, it's not. But it's not just the $1,400 check. On top of that is this expanded child tax credit that will give $3,000 this year to people for every child of the age 16 to 17, and it'll give $3,600 for every child under six. And also now the expanded child care credit. So many people obviously who are trying to get back to work or search for jobs, they need to put their child in some sort of child care, particularly young kids. And now you can, that is going up to $4,000 that you can get back from the government for that.
Wow. Heather, I want to just get back to one thing you mentioned earlier about the partisan split on this bill. Not a single Republican in the Senate voted in favor of it. Why did Senate Republicans not get behind the pandemic aid package, even when they supported the last few rounds of federal relief?
Well, some of it is politics, but the arguments they make publicly are that it's too big. The price, final price tag is the $1.9 trillion. And they also argue that a lot of this aid is not directly tied to COVID. So they would have supported things like more unemployment insurance and more money for vaccines. But there was a lot of pushback about all the money going to state and local. And I had to say it, but there was a lot of pushback about the anti-poverty programs. Not that Republicans didn't think that that's a valid thing to do, but they were questioning why it's in an emergency relief bill. Democrats obviously said, look, you tried to play the same game in 2009 coming out of the Great Recession. We made the bill smaller. And as Schumer said yesterday, we cut back on the stimulus and it resulted in five more years of recession. So Democrats were not having any of this, let's cut the bill down argument.
Although they did cut out of the bill a $15 federal minimum wage mandate, and that's something that 59% of Americans support. Is this something, the minimum wage, that could come back later on in the Biden administration? Are Democrats going to keep pushing this?
Well, they're certainly indicating they're going to try. I think the hardest debate for the White House is there's fairly widespread support to raise the federal minimum wage from $7.25 an hour to something like $11 or $12 an hour. They could probably get bipartisan support and even business support for that. So the question is, do they try to go to $15 and can they actually do that? That's where you see a lot of pushback, is the $15 number is pretty high in certain parts of the country, West Virginia, and places like Mississippi. So that's where the pushback comes. I think it's going to be a really hard choice for Biden.
So the expanded child tax credit is only expected to last the year, and families can use it to pay rent, buy groceries, pay for babysitters. But what could taking away this benefit after just 1 year mean for those families? Are members of the Democratic Party hoping that the expanded child tax credit will last beyond this year? Is that something that's possible?
You've hit on one of the biggest problems, if you will, with this bill, and that is, yes, it's arguably the biggest anti-poverty action from the government in decades, but it only lasts, most of the aid only lasts for 2021, for 1 year. And so sitting here a year from now in 2022, a lot of families are suddenly going to feel like they are taking a hit on their income, that suddenly their income is $3,000 to $4,000 or $5,000 less. There is certainly a lot of hope among Democratic leaders in the White House that a number of these programs can be expanded and made permanent, particularly that child tax credit and the expanded earned income tax credit and some of the health care subsidies in this bill. But that's not guaranteed.
Before I let you go, Heather, we know that Black and Hispanic families have borne the brunt of the coronavirus and then the resulting economic downturn. What does this pandemic aid mean for Black and Hispanic families specifically? Are you able to drill down on that?
Obviously, Black and Hispanic families have seen some of the slowest rebound in jobs, particularly Black women, even sitting here in March of 2021 when some of the economy has recovered. Because of the focus on the bottom 40% of Americans, the Black and Hispanic families would get a bigger and in some ways would get a bigger boost from this bill. So when we talk about 13 million Americans being lifted above the poverty line, doesn't mean that they're going to be having, you know, everything will be fine, but they would be above the poverty line. It would really, really boost a lot of Black and Hispanic families above that poverty line.
Heather Long is an economics correspondent for The Washington Post. Thanks, Heather.
Thanks, Matt.
Getting a vaccine right now might depend on who you know, how lucky you are, not whether or not you're next in line. And that has a lot of people, a lot of you, angry, especially if you haven't been able to get your shot. This anger has also extended to the point where people are shaming the people they know who received the vaccine before them, accusing them of jumping the line. But as Nicholas Evans, an assistant professor of philosophy at the University of Massachusetts Lowell, explains, vaccine shaming is misguided, since inequities with the rollout are based on systemic problems rather than individual actions.
What we're seeing is that the background infrastructural injustices that exist in the United States of America have mapped on to the way that we have tried to do vaccine distribution in ways that exacerbate the inequalities that exist in this country.
I spoke with Nick, breaking down vaccine shame, vaccine guilt, and vaccine envy. We started by talking about how he views inequities amid the pandemic.
I mean, it's a combination of things we more or less knew were likely to happen, combined with, I think, in many practitioners' minds, a sense of shock that the worst cases that we thought could arise were in some ways not nearly bad enough. We didn't expect that people would be quite so blasé about the pandemic, at least on the level of government in the United States or the United Kingdom. And we didn't expect that to go on for so long as death tolls mounted. And so I think in some ways this has been a real wake-up call that there's been a lot of moderate discourse in bioethics about what we ought to do during pandemics. And I think that we're slowly coming to the realization that maybe that was just a little bit too moderate and slightly more radical solutions are needed.
What kind of radical solutions?
We should push much harder for a unified public health system in this country, that public health system should be disentangled at least as much as it can be or should be from political actors, that we lack an institutional memory of really any kind in public health, at least at the highest level of this country, because we continue to form ad hoc task forces to deal with pandemics rather than appropriately fund and staff the actual groups that would be most appropriate to deal with this. And then finally, that the longstanding injustices in American healthcare, including the lack of access to affordable healthcare, are only weaknesses when it comes to a disease like COVID-19, and that there really is no reason to not have universal health coverage as a form of protection against pandemics.
So let's talk about vaccine shame and what that is and how some of these systemic problems with distribution might be exacerbating this.
So vaccine shame, I think, is a really interesting phenomenon because it's actually pretty multi-layered. On the one hand, we have, I think, what anyone who lives online, which is all of us at the moment, is probably familiar with, which is people shaming each other or shaming people in general for, quote unquote, jumping the queue when it comes to getting access to a vaccine. So in my own home state of Massachusetts, the governor had to discontinue allowing carers of people who were eligible for vaccines from getting vaccinated at the same time, because by the state of Massachusetts view, people were cutting the line by claiming to be carers when in fact they were not, just for the purposes of getting a vaccine. So finding yourself a grandparent that you can latch onto so you can get vaccinated early. Then we have, I think, the standing shame. And a colleague of mine who is an ancient philosopher, so she studies Plato, has pointed out there's the public shame that people are feeling when they get vaccinated legitimately according to the frameworks that have been laid out by the states, but perhaps a little bit earlier than they otherwise should have been. So you might be declared essential personnel, for example, if you work in science that is attached to a hospital, but even though you have never stepped foot in the hospital for the purpose of treating patients during this pandemic, and you live and work at home like the rest of us, and you can do all of your work from a computer, you're still eligible for the vaccine. And increasingly, I think we're seeing people who are entitled to the vaccine under the framework, but perhaps not under the ethics of this distribution, feel a sense of concern or even shame around how and why they got the vaccine in the first place.
So should those people feel shame? Should somebody who works at a hospital but does not practice medicine, works in an administrative office, but was eligible and, you know, took the place in line, should that person feel any degree of shame over getting vaccinated?
In what might be the most philosopher answer ever, I think that it depends on what you mean by shame, right? So it's not clear to me that they should feel deeply personally responsible for committing their own injustice. They haven't been stealing vaccines, but maybe what they should feel is shame at the scientific and medical and public health infrastructure of this country has been designed in such a way that people benefit from those injustices when, if they weren't to benefit from them, we might all be better off, right? So as someone who works in health policy, I do at times feel a sense of shame about what this country does to its most vulnerable in the name of public health. And I think a lot of other people should think that this is a totally acceptable kind of shame to feel. So if you're a scientist and you've received a vaccine perhaps earlier than you should have, I think that it's acceptable to feel this more general sense of shame at the way that science, medicine, and public health in this country are constructed. And certainly from time to time, I do feel a sense of shame at what our system does to the most vulnerable people in society, and the fact that we could change this if we wanted to, but we haven't.
But then, given that, you feel a more universal shame, if you will, about the systemic issues that we are complacent about on a normal daily basis. But if you have the opportunity to get the shot, and you should you get the shot and feel the shame at the same time?
Yeah, I don't think that there's any contradiction in that, right? We benefit from injustice all the time. Well, my accent is from Australia. My passport is from the United States of America. But, you know, I have lived in two colonial nations. My ancestors were the people who took land away from the indigenous populations of Australia. I know that I can feel happy to be born in Australia and received all the opportunities that I have, but still feel a sense of shame at the ways that came to be. And so I think that you can feel relieved that you have a vaccine and you feel safe from this terrible disease, and that depending on which vaccine you have, you are less likely to give it to the people that you love and care about, but also feel this kind of deep, universal sense of shame at the reasons why you are able to benefit from that.
Nick, people seem to also be hustling any way they can to access vaccines, mostly because, as you said earlier, the state has not done its proper job with vaccine distribution. Is there anything immoral about actively jumping the line when circumstances are so precarious?
I think that that's one of the hardest questions that we have to ask ourselves on a personal level about getting this vaccine. Obviously, there's this case where, you know, your friend at CVS rings you and says, hey, we have a bunch of Moderna vaccines or Pfizer vaccines, the mRNA vaccines in the fridge. We had to crack them out of the really, really cold storage. They aren't going to last, and we need to give them to people before close of business, and we've run out. It seems like it would be wrong to allow those vaccines, which are still a very scarce resource, to go to absolute waste, right? On the other hand, if they are just setting up vaccine appointments and your buddy at a hospital goes, hey, I can get you in, then I think that you have to ask yourself some really hard questions about what you're doing. Because that's not, you know, taking what's left because otherwise it will go to waste. That's potentially taking someone else's spot, and those spots are in short supply. It's really hard in some places to get an appointment at all. And if you're actively engaged in the process of getting one of those appointments when you can afford to not get a vaccine right now, I mean, I can afford to not get a vaccine right now because I work from home, then I think that, yeah, you're doing something wrong.
So are you going to get vaccinated? What's your vaccination plan, given that you do work from home and like you said, can afford to not do it immediately?
So I am, according to, I guess, the federal level of kind of distribution schemes, I'm a phase two. So I am one of the people who gets vaccinated after everybody else. My wife is a phase one. She hasn't got her vaccine yet, but she will soon, I hope. I plan to wait it out. Right. I plan to wait until the state of Massachusetts tells me that it's time to get a vaccine. Why? Because I'm a college professor. I can and will work from home until I am forced to return to my job and my daily duties on campus. And I can afford, you know, whatever premiums are necessary to have things delivered to my house and to live safely and isolated until this pandemic is over or until I have access to a vaccine in the ethical framework that has been set out for prioritizing these vaccines as a scarce resource. And yeah, it sucks. I'm an extrovert. I really want to see my friends. But I would rather, you know, someone with three comorbidities get access to a vaccine before me. And I would rather all of those people get access to a vaccine before me and my friends' grandparents or parents before I go and get a vaccine. My postdoc advisor just got a vaccine and because he was eligible. And I would much rather he stay alive than to think that someone like him died or could have died because I cut in line first.
you're following the state guidelines, the federal guidelines for this. What if somebody disagrees with the guidelines, doesn't think that a smoker, for example, should be ahead of them in line? How is somebody supposed to face that quandary?
So I think that we face that in the same ways as we face the fact that sometimes our states aren't listening to the guidelines that have been set down in the first place, right? If you think that the vaccine framework is unethical, then, you know, go for your life. Go and criticize it and protest it and call your congressman and call your state reps until, you know, you get the change that you need. But I would also point out that if you're making judgments such as, well, smokers don't deserve the vaccines, or people who are overweight don't deserve the vaccines, and so on and so forth, just remember that everyone is going to be disabled at some point. Right? Everyone is going to have a health condition at some point. And you may not today, you may not tomorrow, but one day you will, and it will happen for the rest of your life. And that the American obsession with blaming people for their good or ill health is one of the most toxic parts of our society. And the sooner it goes the way of the dodo, the better.
How has shame been expressing itself in real life and interpersonal relationships when it comes to vaccine distribution?
I haven't seen a lot of personal vaccine shaming. I've seen a little bit when, you know, the parents of colleagues or friends who are not currently eligible for a vaccine in their home state try to wrangle vaccines out of their healthcare worker family members and things like that. And yeah, I think that, you know, people have to have those hard discussions with their families that, you know, yes, mom, yes, dad, I'm a doctor, I'm a nurse, I'm an epidemiologist at a medical institution, I could get you a vaccine, I guess, if I wanted to. But you need to kind of support the pandemic as a whole. And I can't by craft or by graft get you that vaccine. So I think that there is some shaming that is going on there. Honestly, and you know, I think this is endemic in all social situations, most of the shaming that I see is online, right? Of, you know, news stories or tweets or Facebook posts about this person or that person cutting in line, and people kind of trying to shame each other for the purposes of deterring people from going to get those vaccines. As far as I can tell, it hasn't really worked.
Right. And there's different kinds of shame, I imagine, that you see online, like shaming smokers or people who are overweight for accessing the vaccine when theoretically they could have, you know, prevented that condition. And then shaming wealthy people who go to poor neighborhoods for their vaccines. There's like different kinds of shame that happen online, I guess.
Yeah. And I think that maybe something that would be really interesting for the listeners out there is there's also a form of counter shaming that is beginning. And I saw this perhaps about 4 or 5 days ago when I saw a tweet by someone who said, I'm overweight and I was entitled to get a vaccine. And I got one. The medical system in this country has treated me so poorly over the decades of my life that I feel that because of this, I am entitled to this vaccine. Don't let people shame you for being overweight and being entitled to a vaccine because you have another comorbidity that puts you in the relevant tier for the framework for allocation, right? So there was a bit of counter-shaming that the reasons that some people are higher on the framework than others is because they've been mistreated by the medical system for so long that they are now in a position where their bodies are vulnerable to death by COVID and are thus eligible for the vaccine before other people. So, you know, I think that there are some really interesting dynamics here, not just around shaming, but around what I've just called counter shaming, because people who are eligible for the vaccine are tired of being told that they should not be eligible for the vaccine, which in their minds is another way of saying that people are comfortable with them dying over living.
Nicholas Evans is assistant professor of philosophy at the University of Massachusetts Lowell. Nick, this was so interesting. I hope your number gets called soon. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks so much, Matt.
We asked you, how are you feeling about the vaccine rollouts?
My name is Steve from Merrick, Long Island. I received my first Moderna vaccine 3 weeks ago, and I received my second on this coming Saturday. I am very excited about getting the second vaccine. I wanted it right from the get-go. No guilt whatsoever. And I hope and pray that everyone gets it as soon as they possibly can.
Hi, my name is Debbie Hemingway. I'm calling from Winters, California. I've had two doses, and I feel no guilt or shame, and I don't know why I should. My state and county and healthcare provider have determined that people in my age group should be protected. I would like to see an even faster and more universal rollout, but I'm not going to be shamed for protecting myself, my family, and my community.
It seems like everyone I know is getting vaccinated, from family friends who are Trump supporters and would not be quiet about the mask mandate, to people my age who are just lying through their teeth about their profession. I'm 36, not necessarily on the front lines, and I have a three-month-old child who I'm very concerned about, but I am proud to wait my turn.
I'm Tammy, and I'm calling from St. Louis. When you texted, I was in the process of getting the Johnson & Johnson one shot. My condition is obesity. I've spent a lifetime being treated badly because of my weight, with no attempt to understand the complex issues involved. So I don't feel one tiny bit of guilt. It's the one time that being overweight has worked in my favor.
Hi, my name is Alice, and I'm from Cresco, Pennsylvania. I've lost a lobe of my lung, and I still have to go every 6 months for CAT scans to make sure it hasn't come back. So no, I don't feel guilty that I've had the vaccine. Neither do I feel jealous of the people who got it before me, because there are lots of folks out there who have far greater exposure or are at a much higher risk. What I am really frustrated about is how hard it was to find a vaccine. I was on the computer for days before I scored one. It should be a lot easier to find this vaccine in order to make it equitable.
This is Jessica in Hayward, California. I am relatively young, in my early 30s, and I was able to get my first dose of vaccine on Monday. I do feel a little guilty about being able to get it, because I know a couple elderly people who have not been able to get it, and it's really frustrating that the vaccine is not available for them to get, but it was super easy for me to get. My work qualified me, and so I jumped on it, and you know, I'm hoping to help these friends be able to get vaccinated at some point.
Okay, folks, we're midway through the week. Glad to have you along for the ride. If you want to follow me on Twitter, I'm at MattKatz00, and the show is at The Takeaway. If you want to comment on any of the stories you heard today, head to the website and click on Contact Us. Easy breezy way to make your voice part of the show. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Matt Katz, in for Tanzina, and this is The Takeaway.